May I have your attention, please?
Your attention, please?
May I have your attention, please?
May I have your attention?
And indeed, if that does not get your attention, I don't know what will. That is the official theme song, perhaps, for Attention, Please. Well, I'm going to tell you that. I'm going to welcome you to Attention, Please. Actually, we air Attention, Please at KPTZ to foster appreciation for the good work being done in our community. Good work by individuals, by businesses, and by organizations. I'm Phil Andrus. My guest for this week's Attention, Please is Tara McCauley. She is the interim executive director of the Jefferson County Historical Society. I will be chatting with Tara about the Society's active summer schedule, in particular, however, a pair of walking tours, which Society members and volunteers are leading around downtown Port Townsend. And welcome, Tara.
Thank you so much for having me, Phil.
Always a pleasure to see you and to work with you. And we have worked together for things like the Holiday Extravaganza.
Yes.
You are the mistress of trivia at our extravaganza. Yes. But we're not going to be trivial this afternoon. Let's see. Before we get to the tours, what else is on your summer schedule for folks to do, tourists and local folks as well? The Historical Society in the museum or elsewhere?
Yeah, well, all of our sites are open. So you may know we operate four different sites at the Historical Society. We have two historic house museums, the Commanding Officers' Quarters, which is over in Fort Warden, and the Rothschild House, which is uptown. The Rothschild House is open Fridays and Saturdays for visitation. COQ, as we call the Commanding Officers' Quarters, is open Thursday through Sunday. Of course, the museum is open downtown. We've got kind of your last chance to see two of our current exhibitions, our landscapes exhibition and our Underwater Street David Eisenhower exhibition, close at the end of this month, and then we're opening two new exhibitions in August. So lots of fun stuff happening at our sites. Our research center is, of course, open Tuesday through Saturday and by appointment for folks who are interested in doing research. So lots going on.
And how important is summer? Tourists coming to the museum, coming to the other sites, and we're going to talk about the walking tours as well, but, you know, the holiday season is big for retail, but I'm thinking that the summer season is big for the Historical Society, and I'm talking financially as well as just fulfillment of mission, I mean.
Yeah, it's a busy time, absolutely. It's a time, I would say it's maybe our busiest time in terms of serving the public, being open, offering programs. We get to be outside, which we love, you know, get out into the community, out into the county. And so it's great, yeah, for locals and tourists alike.
A lot more people coming in the door.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot less of concern for the south wind blowing wind and rain in that front door and rattling it and so forth. So summertime is a good time. Let's get to these tours. And great. I thank you for taking Emmylou and me on a combo tour, it seemed like, because we looked at both murals and lore.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Well, we took you joined us for the Legends and Lore tour, but we talk a little bit about the murals in that tour, and we talk a little bit about lore in the murals tour, so there's some crossover there.
So you mix them up. Do not worry about spoilers. I think that we're not on television. If people were able to see these places, then maybe we would be spoiling the fun. But with radio, we can only entice them to join your tours, and that is what I think we're trying to do, and I would like to see us do. So everything you say will not spoil the fun. It will amplify their curiosity. That is how we should look at it. And Vanishing Murals, let's start there.
Yeah, so Vanishing Murals is a walking tour in downtown Port Townsend. We look at eight different murals, some historical, some more contemporary. We talk about sort of the backdrop to why a town like ours, and maybe folks have noticed, has so many of these historic murals on so many of these historic buildings. You know, the murals are there because the buildings are there, right? So we sort of set the stage around why our town looks the way it does, why we have this these well-preserved murals. And then we talk a little bit about what each mural is advertising, the aesthetics of each mural. We worked with a font expert in developing this tour, which was so much fun. So we'll look at sort of the, you know, the typeface of the murals and talk about the rise of the Victorian era, sort of unregulated font extravaganza, if you will. It's really, really, it's a fun one.
And when were these painted? I mean, I realize there would be a span of time, mm-hmm. but roughly, a set of decades, perhaps.
Yeah. Many of the historic murals that we're looking at were part of advertising campaigns that were run sometime around the turn of the last century. So let's say, 1890 to 1910-ish. Some of the murals we look at, again, are more contemporary, some painted as recently as the early 2000s. Those are painted in a style to kind of hearken that Victorian aesthetic.
You said some were painted in the early 2000s?
Mm-hmm.
Where? Which ones?
You'll have to take the tour.
Well, we're taking the tour. We are in tight. Remember that? We're enticing people to come.
Yes.
It's
Let's
okay
see.
To describe them.
One I could point out, it was actually painted in the 80s, which is the Holly's Flowers mural on the McCurdy Building in downtown, if you can picture where that mural is.
Mm-hmm.
That mural was painted in 1986, for example. So a more contemporary mural with that looks quite historic, is Victorian in its style, right?
How important do you reckon these murals were for actually advertising and selling products?
Oh, they were huge. Two of our maybe biggest, most recognizable historic murals would be the Bull Durham Smoking Tobacco mural and the Owl Cigar mural, right? Both of those campaigns at their time were huge. Tens of thousands of those murals were painted across the country. And this is at a time when consumer products are sort of exploding, being mass produced and being sold, and the advertising industry kind of rises up with that. And so how successful were they in terms of selling tobacco? I think very. And they really, these murals really were part of this massive, massive, massive campaign nationwide. So,
regarding the Bull Durham advertisement, the mural, the wall of this building, if another building were built adjacent to it, it would disappear. And yet that has never happened.
Yeah.
I wonder why.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, maybe there's an easement on the property. But mind you, a good bit of expense went into putting that mural on the wall and sustaining it as well. Mm-hmm. And it could just become totally invisible in history forever if someone were to build next door. So I just wonder what the details. It's been – when does that – the Bull Durham, when does that date back to?
Yeah, again, right around the turn of the last century. So we don't have the exact date of when that mural was painted, but that advertising campaign kicked off in the early 1890s and ran for several decades.
So 120 years, that wall has been open to the world. That's, I think, is pretty remarkable given that that's valuable downtown real estate next door.
Yeah.
What do we know about the artist?
We don't know about the artist. We know broadly that sign painters of this era that would have been involved in these large-scale national mural painting campaigns likely would have worked in pairs. They likely would have traveled the country painting these murals. They painted them by hand. These are freehand painted murals. They would have been paid, somewhere between $5 and $10 per mural. Some of these teams of sign painters could bust these out in a day, maybe 2 days. So
Bull Durham in a day?
They were pros.
Holy smokes.
Pros.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it'd take a day to put up the scaffolding, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Even that would have been. I wonder how many people broke various – we won't talk about that because it was risky work. Some of the murals were not so high off the ground, but that one is, how many stories?
That one is quite
four
high.
Stories high.
Yeah.
How about the paints? I mean, painting, brick is not the kind of medium that I would think paint would adhere well to and would last well against. Do we know anything about the paints?
Yeah. I mean, I think we know that there's an ingredient in paint historically that is not used in paint anymore,
right?
Are
we talking about lead?
We are talking about lead.
It's okay to use the word.
So lead paint certainly lends itself to lasting a little bit longer against those brick backdrops. I think, too, various murals of this era were painted in what is called a banner style. So the background would have been a solid color, and often muralists would add some kind of plaster to the background paint to kind of smooth that out and create a little bit more of a stable base or foundation for the mural. And we know that these murals have been, there have been conservation efforts, you know, over the last 100+ years for some of these murals. So some of them have been touched up, you know, repainted, restored, things like that.
Well, interesting you mentioned that, because I was thinking about just that matter. There are regulations, historical, not your society, but we'll say the state society, the state organization, whatever it's called, governing what can be done to historical things, and I would assume these murals are protected.
Yeah, yeah, and it's actually so. This our city has some things to do with how the murals are protected, as does the federal government. So things on the National Register, places that are protected or are national landmarks on the Historic Registry, those are all governed by a set of federal regulations around how. And if they can be changed, you know, destroyed, taken away, protected, et cetera.
Yeah. So they belong to history, right? Mm-hmm. They belong to all of us, right? But they really belong to the building owners.
Correct.
Okay. And if a building owner wanted to have something else on the wall, for example, that would be difficult to accomplish. I should imagine, I should hope.
Yeah. Yes, I think it would be. And, you know, I'm not an expert on this, but my understanding about the regulation there is that the only way you really could get rid of one of these historic murals is if the structural integrity of the building was at risk. And I think there is some precedent for that has happened. But other than that, they are well protected.
Restoration was the term you used. Is there funding available for a property owner, for a building owner, wanting to restore, we'll just say, Bull Durham to its former glory? It's disappearing. You know, these are vanishing, as you say.
Yeah.
Is there funding available to building owners to do that restoration?
I would imagine so, yeah. I mean, I know that there is funding available for all different kinds of historic building restoration, so I would imagine there is for murals as well. I don't know that for sure, but I would imagine that.
One would hope so.
Yeah.
Well, again, emphasizing we have no spoilers here.
Yeah.
Your tour, the Vanishing Murals tour, mm-hmm. What else do people see besides Bull Durham?
Yeah, let's see. We look at the Bull Durham mural. We look at Owl Cigar. We look at a really sweet, small, pretty hidden historic mural on the side of the Terry Building that is one of my favorites to point out. We look at the First National Bank mural. We look at the Eisenbeiss Cracker Factory mural. We look at a couple more contemporary murals, like I mentioned. There's a bunch of them. That's not all of them, but there's a bunch of them.
I can tell you, because I went with you, that there's some that I had not seen.
Yeah.
You know, there's the obvious ones that are really profoundly clear, that they're notable. I was wondering, too, history is happening at the moment. There's especially one building in downtown Port Townsend that every time I go out on the water, I look at it, and I wonder, what would it take to have finally a mural put on the back of the building that houses the mercantile and whatever else is in that building? It's just a blank to the world. Are murals being painted in circumstances like that? And how would a community member or a set of community members bring this notion of painting murals to the present, into the present, to the now?
Yeah. So let's see. If I understand your question correctly, the first part of the question is, are there murals being painted in Port Townsend currently? And I think the answer to that is yes. There are lots of examples of more contemporary murals around our town. Who would one take that to? My guess is the city. I imagine it starts with the city.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, as you've been on the waterfront here, I believe.
I have.
On the water, and you've probably looked at that blank wall. I've been looking at that blank wall from Port Townsend Bay since 1985, when we bought our first sailboat, and wishing that there was something to decorate that wall.
What would you put on it, Phil?
Oh, Tara, you're asking me questions.
It sounds like you've got some ideas, opinions.
I think that would be scenes of the sea, I would say. Now, mind you, it could be historical scenes. It could be, you know, why is it when I think of historical scenes, I think of Shanghaiing and prostitutes, but it is the first thing that came to my mind. But, you know, something associated with the present and the past of the town.
Mm-hmm. Something illustrative, it sounds like.
I think that's what I would. What would you do then?
Oh, I have no ideas at this time. I'd have to think about it.
Ah, well, you can think about it for the next 15 minutes or so, and maybe you have an answer. Setting aside the vanishing murals, the legends and lore of Port Townsend, another tour.
Yeah. Yeah. So Legends and Lore is a new tour. Vanishing Murals, this is our third summer offering the Vanishing Murals tour. Legends and Lore is new this year, and it's a really fun one. So, again, I was able to have you and Emmylou join us on one of the tours. But really what we were thinking about in designing this tour is we live in a community that is so rich with story, right? Since I've moved to Port Townsend, it's been almost 4 years working at the Historical Society. I hear so many of these stories that community members share. These stories of lore, and it really, and people love these stories. They're entertaining, they're interesting, some of them are mysterious. And we started thinking, sort of, first of all, what is the relationship between history and lore? You know, are those, They're connected, certainly, and what is that connection was kind of our first question. And then what do we know about these stories? What do we actually know? What's supported in the historic record around these stories of lore that are so popular and so common? And wouldn't it be fun if we did a tour that sort of leaned into these stories and shared these stories, and then also unpacked what we know and what we don't, you know, based on our collections and the historic record as we currently understand it. And so that's the tour, and it's. I hope you think it was a lot of fun.
Well, it actually was a lot of fun, and it was informative as well.
Yeah.
But we need examples here, Tara. What lore, what legends, where do you take people?
Sure.
I can tell you where you took me, but that would not be right. It should be you telling the story.
Yeah, let's see. So the Bouldera mural also makes an appearance in this tour, in the Legends and Lore tour, and a story that I have been told many times about the Bouldera mural is a story that involves a sort of a proper Victorian woman who lived in Uptown, who shortly after the mural was painted, was offended, had some concerns about the mural itself. The mural, if you can picture it, features this large red bull, and this particular proper Victorian socialite was concerned with the bull's anatomy being on display in this mural. And she complained to city officials, and city officials acted quickly in response to this concern and painted a gate over the bull, right? So this is a story that, have you heard, you know, when I first moved to Port Townsend and started at the Historical Society, people told me this story multiple times. I'm sure you've heard the story of, you know, the Victorian woman in Port Townsend and the Bouldera mural. So there's one example, right, of a story that we'd heard many, many, many times.
Making the bull into a cow without udders.
Just strategically putting a gate in the imagery, strategically placing a gate in the imagery. And so that was one of the stories, for example. And so we said, gosh, what do we know about this, you know?
We don't need to go any farther into explaining what you did learn.
Yeah.
Because there's quite a little bit to the story beyond what you just told.
Yeah.
How about the story of Jack London?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very well-known story in Port Townsend, and is connected to our museum, the Jefferson Museum of Art and History, which, of course, originally was the City Hall building, built in 1892. And the story goes that Jack London, you know, soon to be famous writer Jack London, but at the time UC Berkeley College student Jack London, is heading north to the Yukon, participating in the gold rush, leaves from San Francisco, stops over in Port Townsend, and while, you know, to change ships and get on another ship that heads then up to Alaska. And while he's in Port Townsend, he is enjoying himself immensely. He's, you know, seen around town at bars, at brothels. He's sort of holding court and gets himself into a bit of trouble that lands him. There's a bit more to the story, but ultimately the punchline is it lands him in the city jail, in the jail in our historic City Hall building. And the story is told in many places, many versions of this story, that Jack London spent the night in our historic City Hall jail.
And I would imagine the story has in part its basis in the fact that Jack London probably did spend some nights and probably some days and some nights in jails elsewhere.
I think that's that is what has been so much fun about researching this tour, is that lore, I mean, these stories are so often based in what can be supported by the historic record, right? They don't just appear out of thin air. They come from something. And certainly I imagine this one came from something as well.
And here we have the notion of fact, and we have the notion of fiction, and we have the notion of lore. And you, as a historian, are trying to ferret out the fact from the fiction. But can you not at times destroy the fun of the fiction and even the value of the lore by putting it on paper, by finding out the truth for sure, if, in fact, there is a truth for sure? Because I know enough historians to know that you don't always agree with each other. You're probably kind of like lawyers and so forth, have differences of opinion. But still, once you take this cool story and find the truth of it, might you not destroy it?
Oh, there's a lot to unpack there. Let's see. Well, first of all, I need to make the very clear statement that I am not a historian. I am a museum professional. I am a lover of history. I'm an educator.
Phil Andrus designates you a historian. on this afternoon on the 10th of July.
I'm a hobbyist.
All right. It means your degree
historian.
Is in something else.
That's correct.
Yes.
In museology, which sounds like a made-up word, but is, in fact, the study of museums. I think – so there's that. In terms of, is there such a thing as fact in history, I think part of what we try to illustrate in this tour is that our understanding of history is always changing. And, you know, the ways that history has been recorded, you know, when you talk about ruining the fun, I think maybe I would ask, ruining the fun for who? You know, depending on how these stories go, depending on who's represented in the historic record, I think, you know, we know, of course, that throughout history, so many people's experiences and stories and lives have been excluded from the historic record. And hopefully, you know, the function of doing good history is to come to a better understanding of the more complex and inclusive and holistic experiences from our past, right? So I think, does it ruin the fun? I think, you know, I hope not. And I think if there's something, too, about, you know, if we believe in the function of history as being a tool that helps us understand where we are in the world and helps us make good decisions about our future, then I think coming to as close to an actual understanding of our history as we can is important. That said, you know, what we try to do in this tour is not pit the two against each other, is not say there is lore and there is history and the two are at odds, right? It is to say there is what is sort of supported in the historic record. There are these stories that we tell, and they are so connected. And having that critical eye around what we hear and what we understand is hopefully what people are leaving our tour thinking. Oh gosh, there's all these stories that I hear too, and I wonder where they come from, and I wonder what can be supported in the historic record and what can't be.
And what does lore, whether supported or not, in the historic record, what does it add to our appreciation and our sense of our place right here?
Yeah, oh, that's a great question. Gosh. You know, I think the stories, you know, if we think of lore as being part of our history that is passed down orally, right? So we think of lore as stories and the stories that we tell. I just think that particular methodology is so rich and so interesting. And the stories that we share with one another, the stories that we share at our dinner tables, the stories that we share when we're out with our friends, you know, there is something that is so much about human connection around lore, and there is so much something about what we think is interesting, what we think is important, what we think has maybe a meaningful message. And I think that there's something there that, that is special and that is cool. And a town like Port Townsend that has such a rich, has such a rich history, and also it has such a rich visual reference to that history with that downtown corridor, is sort of ripe for lore, if you will.
And I'm going to need to start wrapping this up soon, so we need details. How much time do these tours take?
They're all downtown.
So there's no uphill, downhill involved.
Yeah, mostly flat. One slight incline, but very gradual. The tours are about, you know, 3/4 of a mile all told, but we – lots of stops – and we offer them on Saturdays. Vanishing Murals is at 11 a.m. Legends and Lore is at 2 p.m. They take about 90 minutes. And folks can learn more on our website, which is jchsmuseum.org.
And do they have to sign up ahead of time, or can they just...
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, pre-registration is required. You know, you can sign up as close to the time as half an hour before, but pre-registration is required. And they're filling up. We keep tour groups to 12 so that we have a really nice, manageable group of folks.
Well, now, I am going to have to draw this conversation to a close. There's music in the background, and it is on purpose. Tara McCauley is the Interim Executive Director of the Historical Society, and thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
Next week on Attention, Please, I'm going to be speaking with Arian True, who is the 2023 Poet Laureate for Washington State, and Catherine Hunt, who is the producer of the series Poetry on the Salish at Wilderby Farm. Attention, Please airs on Mondays and at noon and at 5 also, and on Saturdays at noon, and it becomes a podcast just after its first broadcast, which is to say, very, very shortly here, the music you hear in the background, soon to be in the foreground, is titled either The Old Settler or Acres of Clams. Most people know it as that. It's sung by the Terriers, and that's a folk group from the 1960s, which included the recently late Alan Arkin. That's why I wanted to play this one. It's composed by Francis D. Henry, said to have been a judge in Washington's pioneer days, but we're not sure about that. So there's a bit of lore for you. Thank you to Tara again. Thank you to all for listening. I'm Phil Andrus.
And started one morning to shank it. For her country they call Puget Sound. For her country they call Puget Sound. For her country they call Puget Sound. I started one morning to shank it. For her country they call Puget Sound. No longer the slave of ambition, I laugh at the world and its shams. And I think of my happy condition, surrounded by acres of clams.
We have a couple of minutes before we're going to start the community calendar. Since Tara is still here, are you leading the tours?
Some of them.
Yes. Well, I will tell you, Emily and I both commented upon how wonderfully you led the tour we were on.
Oh, thank you so much. You're really good at that.
And Bill Tennant, who was a director of the museum, he's leading some. And who else?
He is, yeah. Bill Tennant, our tour program coordinator, Kelsey Kotebeck. We've got some other tour guides as well. We've got a group of about 4 tour guides.
And I told you during the course of the tour, before or after perhaps, that when the management here at this radio station realizes they need to get rid of me, that I would really enjoy leading tours. It was a fun thing to do, just to walk around downtown, and there were good, jolly people who were part of your tour.
You would be a great tour guide, Phil. You're hired.
So I first have to get fired. And anyway, again, Tara, a pleasure. This is KPTZ. We are in Port Townsend, Washington. We are listener-supported. I talk about that a lot because I think it's really, really important.